We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
Good afternoon. This is the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580 and FM 90.9 HD2, online at will.illinois.edu. My name is Celeste Quinn. Thanks for tuning in today. As we make our way through the recession, we've had occasion to look back to the policies the Roosevelt administration put in place to alleviate the suffering caused by the Great Depression. This afternoon, we're going to take a look at the life of the architect of the New Deal, Frances Perkins. Journalist Kirsten Downey, author of The Woman Behind the New Deal, The Life of Frances Perkins, FDR's Secretary of Labor and His Moral Conscience, is our guest. Frances Perkins, Franklin Roosevelt's Secretary of Labor, was the force behind the introduction of unemployment insurance, the 40-hour work week, a minimum wage, and Social Security. Listeners, I hope you'll join our discussion. If you've got questions or comments, join us with a phone call. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area is 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. We also have a toll-free number. That number is 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Kirsten Downey is a frequent contributor to The Washington Post, where she was a staff writer from 1988 to 2008, winning Press Association awards for her business and economics reporting. And she shared in the 2008 Pulitzer Prize for the paper's coverage of the Virginia Tech shootings. Her book, The Woman Behind the New Deal, is published by Nantelis Doubleday, and you'll find our guest online at www.kirstendowney.com. D-O-W-N-E-Y. 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Kirsten Downey, good to talk with you. How are you?
Oh, hello, Celeste. Thank you so much for having me.
My pleasure.
Sure.
Well, when Frances Perkins met with then-President-elect Roosevelt in 1933 about becoming Secretary of Labor, she had a firm idea of what she wanted to accomplish, and she listed for him quite a number of goals. What were they?
Yes, it's really, really fascinating. She had, over a lifetime, she'd been a social worker, and she'd been the industrial commissioner for the state of New York, which meant that she was very familiar with economic and workplace conditions in what was and remains to be one of our most important industrial states. And so she had given this a great deal of thought. She'd seen the Depression coming on, and she had sort of a list that she'd put together of things that she thought could improve conditions, help relieve some of the suffering, but also position the economy for recovery in the future. And her list included a 40-hour work week, a minimum wage, workers' compensation, unemployment compensation, a federal law banning child labor, direct federal aid for unemployment relief, Social Security, public employment, and national health insurance. Mm. Of that list, all were accomplished except for national health insurance.
Why didn't health insurance come to be with Frances Perkins at the helm? She had so many accomplishments.
Well, it's really interesting. I think that that has always been a hot potato in American politics. In 1934, it was then as it is now. And in fact, the American Medical Association told FDR they would kill Social Security if he persisted in proposing a health insurance program. And he and Frances Perkins decided to drop national health insurance to save Social Security.
Mm. Well, okay, so Francis Perkins is meeting with then-President-elect Roosevelt, and she lists for him all these goals.
Yes.
How did he respond?
Well, you know, he had not run on this kind of a platform at all. He had actually run on a balanced budget platform. He'd been on the forefront of efforts to deal with the Depression as governor of New York, so he intended to do, it was clear that he intended to do some things, but he hadn't run on any sort of a platform like this. He asked her to be his Secretary of Labor, and she deliberated over it long and hard. She didn't really want to do the job on some level, but on another level, she knew it was sort of her calling in life, and she proposed this and really made it a sort of a make-it-or-break-it decision for FDR. You have to allow me to do this or I won't accept the job. And he agreed.
Yeah. So then she was stuck.
Yes. Yes. And she found Washington to be a very difficult place to live and work.
Yeah. Well, let's go back to when she was working for then-Governor Roosevelt as State Industrial Commissioner.
Yes.
And maybe you would tell the story of her disputing then-President Hoover's statement in January 1930 that the Depression was almost over. And here I want to get to the working relationship between Perkins and Roosevelt.
Yes. Well, this is really interesting. It's funny because we've all come to believe that these Bureau of Labor Statistics reports on unemployment are so reliable. This is a fairly new development. In fact, this was another area that Francis Perkins focused on specifically. When these unemployment numbers come out every month, we all feel quite confident that that reflects the best information that they can get on the state of unemployment. But in fact, you know, really, every administration wants to make itself look as good as possible, and Hoover did the same. As the Depression came in, he really started to become increasingly uncomfortable with the unemployment numbers rising and rising and rising because it was making his government look bad. It was making the Republican administration look bad. He, at Christmas time, he took some Christmas hiring numbers and reported them as a huge surge in employment and said that happy days were here again and that nobody needed to worry about unemployment, that things were turning around. Francis Perkins recognized immediately that what he was using as a statistical glitch, Christmas hiring, to represent, to say there had been a change. She was furious because she was studying the economy in New York as industrial commissioner, and she knew it was untrue. She immediately called a press conference and blasted President Hoover for releasing false information that would be causing sadness in a lot of households in America, because her view on this was, if people hear the president says it's getting better, but they have members of their household who are still unable to get jobs, it will make a lot of dissension in those households, because it means that then surely the person in your family that doesn't have the job must be doing something wrong. She was furious at it. She blasted Hoover. The story shot onto the front page all over of papers all over the country. And when the news was already out, she suddenly realized, uh-oh, I forgot to tell the governor I was going to do this.
Forgot to tell the boss.
I forgot to tell the governor that I was going to call a press conference
yeah.
and do this.
Yeah.
And so, she called him up, yeah. told him. He was a little shocked. He said, let's wait and see what happens. But in fact, it got a very favorable response. People were aware that the information, you know, that Hoover was trying to paint in a rosier picture than they were all seeing in their own lives. And as he said to her the next day, bully for you. You did the right thing. And in fact, in the next months, as he ran for president, she became sort of like the avenging statistical angel that when Hoover said things were getting better or that things that they were doing were working, she said, no, they're not. Things are getting worse. More radical action is needed. She disputed his statistics. She was, and she shifted the argument to employment and unemployment, and that paved the way for her to be able to introduce these longer structural changes that would help solve the problem gradually.
Was his selection of Perkins to become Secretary of Labor controversial?
Extremely controversial. It's funny for us to imagine now, but at that time, many labor unions didn't even let women become members at all. So here she was going to become Secretary of Labor at a time that a lot of the unions wouldn't even have allowed her to be a member, much less lead the labor movement in the government. Also, a lot of them were hoping to get the job of labor secretary themselves, so there was a lot of professional jealousy. There was also enormous shock. This is the first time we'd ever had a woman in a presidential cabinet. This is only 13 years after women had first gotten the right to vote nationally. So there was reason for shock on many levels. On the other hand, there was also reason for joy. The League of Women Voters had fought very hard for women to be treated more equitably in public life, and they were thrilled at her selection. Frances Perkins' suffrage friends, who had worked with her to get women the right to vote, were delighted, ecstatic, and much of the public reaction was extremely favorable, but it remained controversial.
Did the union men come around once she began to accomplish things that were good for organized labor?
They did personally, and over time came to believe she was the most valuable Secretary of Labor they had ever had. But it was a slow process, and she had to court them to get them back on her side. She also found that in many cases they were less interested in some of the regulatory and legislative reforms she was proposing because they already had these protections for their own members. Mm. So she had to sort of win their support. Gradually she did, and now, of course, when my book came out in March, the AFL-CIO has been enormously supportive and hosted a big luncheon, sort of a posthumous thanks to Frances Perkins for what she did.
Well, tell us how you first heard the name Frances Perkins.
Well, that's funny. I came from a Republican family myself, and no one talked very much or said very much good about the Roosevelt administration ever. I'm 52, and when I was in college, Frances Perkins was only mentioned perhaps in passing, the first woman named a cabinet official. I really didn't know who she was. I don't think I'd ever even heard her name spoken out loud. In 1988, though, when I came to work at the Washington Post, I took one of those tour bus tours of the city to familiarize myself with the sites because I wasn't from Washington and had to sort of get my bearings. When we passed the Frances Perkins Department of Labor building, I was struck by the fact that there was a whole building named after a woman, and not only that, a woman who I'd barely heard of. So I started to perk up my ears for anything I could hear about her from then on. And in fact, on the same tour, I heard Frances Perkins' name spoken for the first time, and it was part of the comedy shtick that the tour bus driver gave. And it was, as we got down around the mall, he said, what American woman had the worst childbirth experience? It was one of those little things they say to sort of get the crowd involved. Of course, nobody could think of the answer. And he said, Frances Perkins, she spent 12 years in labor.
Mm-hmm.
Now, of course, everyone laughed.
Mm-hmm.
Funny. I laughed.
Mm-hmm.
But I also, the feminist part of me, was irritated by it, too, that clearly this is a woman who had done something so significant that she was the only woman with a federal building named after her. And she'd been reduced to just a throwaway comic line on a bus tour of Washington, D.C. So I started to listen and to learn more. And over the 20 years that I was at the Washington Post, I began to realize what a huge impact she had had on our economy and on our social structure in the United States. You know, you think we used to have, hundreds of thousands of children working in mills. Many of your listeners today will remember their grandparents as children going to work in factories. That stopped because of Frances Perkins. It used to be that people were asked to work typically 16-hour days. We've had some pushback. A lot of workers are working longer days now, but the concept of an 8-hour day became a reality because of Frances Perkins. And most importantly now, as we face this terrible economic slump, more than 50 million people are collecting Social Security benefits. That's different than the Great Depression, when we didn't have any such program. And about 7 million are on unemployment insurance. And that's one of the things that President Obama right now is really relying on to help keep the wolf from the door of the people who've lost their jobs and haven't found other jobs yet.
Yeah. This is The Afternoon Magazine. Our guest this afternoon, journalist Kirsten Downey. She's the author of The Woman Behind the New Deal, The Life of Frances Perkins, FDR's Secretary of Labor and His Moral Conscience. My name is Celeste Quinn. This is The Afternoon Magazine. And listeners, I invite you to join us this afternoon with questions, comments for our guest about Frances Perkins. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. We also have a toll-free number, that number, 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. This is going to, I'm going to ask you to speculate here, but, and I feel you know what question I'm going to ask. We don't know how Frances Perkins would have responded had she been in the cabinet of Barack Obama to what is happening today. But given all the time that you have spent with her, so to speak, what is your sense of what she might have done?
It's pretty clear to me that, of course, her big preoccupation in life and what she was all about was finding ways to give people reliable, stable sources of income. You know, people have to have a steady job. They have to know they're going to be able to keep a job, to pay, to have the courage to buy a home, to have the courage to pay for a college education for themselves and for their children. I think her big issue right now would be, as it was during the Great Depression, finding ways to get people working. Undoubtedly, she would, of course, be supportive of unemployment insurance. That's obviously the program she set up. But she and FDR felt like it was also soul-deadening for people to just be collecting a check instead of having the chance to work. I think she'd be promoting a big expansion of work projects, and that people could get money in exchange for work, not just collecting checks. I think she would also be working very closely with American business to try to find ways to encourage American companies to retain jobs and expand their workforces. This was something, in fact, when we talked about the people who had opposed her nomination, it's notable to think of other people who supported her nomination. In fact, a lot of business leaders, executives at Eastman Kodak, at Filene's department store, at Macy's, at Bloomingdale's, were all people who had spoken up in support of her nomination. She always believed in doing things to work proactively with business. What she did during the Great Depression is she early on began to find ways to celebrate employers who had managed to retain jobs and spread information about how they had done it to make them heroic, to make them heroes, and to find ways to criticize, maybe not directly criticize, but implicitly criticize employers that use the downturn to shed jobs they didn't need to shed. I think that right now she'd be looking at ways to promote jobs, increase employment, and look to which companies are not following the herd right now in shedding jobs, but are doing what really needs to be done for the American economy in trying to keep and expand their employee bases.
Hmm. You wrote a column for the Post some years ago called On the Job, and you received a letter from a worker telling you his boss kept locked kept locking him up at the end of the day while the boss counted the money in the till.
Yes.
And that led you to the story of a horrific fire in New York City in 1911, and Frances Perkins witnessed that fire. This
yes.
marked the beginning of her moving from idealism to action
yes.
and to City Hall.
Yes.
This
yes.
made her a politician of sorts, I would say. It launched her in that direction.
Yes.
Tell us the story.
All right. Frances Perkins was a young social worker in New York. She was about 30 years old. She was associated with the Hull House movement, of course, which your listeners in Illinois, of course, know so well because of Jane Addams and the very important role she played in American history at Hull House. Frances Perkins had gone and lived at Hull House and studied with Jane Addams, was really mentored by Jane Addams, and then went to be a social worker in New York City. She happened to be in Greenwich Village one day on a Saturday afternoon. She was having tea with a friend. They heard a big commotion out in the street, ran outside, ran across Washington Square, and Frances Perkins actually arrived at the base of the building just as to witness one of the most awful and horrifying sights of the earliest 20th century, which was the Triangle Shirtwaist Fire. It was a 10-story building right in Greenwich Village, the top three floors were being used as a sweatshop making Gibson Girl blouses. A fire had started in the building. There were inadequate fire escapes. There were the elevator broke. The people had been locked in, and people finally, in desperation, began jumping out of the windows, of course, to their death. She saw, 146 people died that day, and she was a firsthand witness. Now, she'd been living at Hull House, and she'd seen the important work that Jane Addams and the other social workers were doing, raising awareness of issues. But she saw from this that it isn't enough to raise awareness of issues. Action needs to be taken. She decided to become very active as a civic activist on the issue of workplace hazards, particularly fire safety hazards. A committee on safety was formed with a wealthy donor giving money to fund the effort. And, in fact, it was Teddy Roosevelt who picked her to head this committee on safety. She was enormously successful at getting through dozens of laws that are things that we all live with and use all the time that have saved so many lives. Fire drills, overhead, water sprinklers. The fact that we all know how to exit a building, the whole concept of a fire drill was something that had to be developed at that time. And Frances Perkins helped to guide dozens of laws to passage in New York. She then was the keynote speaker at the National Fire Prevention Association's annual conference in 1913, and she urged the fire safety officials from all over the country to go back to their home states and take what New York had learned. It's been estimated that in 1911, at the time of Triangle Fire, about 1,000 people a day died in industrial accidents in America. And now, even though our population is so much greater, it's now considered a very unusual thing when a number of workers die in a factory or workplace fire. It's an oddity now, and this is all Frances Perkins' handiwork.
Hmm. Well, let's go back in time now to see where she came from. How, given the time, her story is so amazing. She was born Fanny Coralie Perkins in 1880. Tell
yes.
us a little bit about her family and their background.
She came from a middle to upper middle class family in Worcester, Massachusetts. She later sometimes pretended to have come from a wealthier family than she did, but she was pretty much a middle class daughter of a merchant. Her father owned a stationery store in Worcester. She came from an old New England family. And I think that's one of the things that really influenced her enormously is she had a very long sense of family history in America. And she realized that these boom and bust cycles have been a recurring part of American capitalism. And so she knew this from stories. Both her grandmother and her great-grandmother lived to be over 100 years old. So they knew in their own family these stories of how things, you know, when the economy had gone bust at various points and how people had survived. So she comes to her activism with a long sense of what happened before. Now, she had very much of a drive, though, to make a difference. And so, as you've noted, one of the first things she did was change her name. Her name, she was born Fanny, and that's obviously a name that is a disadvantage, particularly for a woman. But she switched her name to Frances, which is sort of a more, respectable name. Somewhat of a stolid name, and is also a gender-neutral name. And she felt like women were often discriminated against for behaving in a frilly way, talking in a female manner, and clearly even having a very feminine name.
Mm. Now, in 1909, she's in New York City, and she's making speeches about feminism and suffrage, and these are fiery speeches.
They're fiery speeches, yes.
How did she come to feminism?
The times were changing. It's important to remember that, you know, she was 40 years old before she even had the right to vote. But she was college educated. Her parents sent her to college. The only child in their family. Her mother hadn't gone, nor did her sister. But there was something in her that they realized was different. They sent her to college. At that time, only 3% of American women went to college. So very early, she found herself in an environment where she was questioning whether women were being treated fairly in the opportunities they had compared to men. When she got to New York as a social worker, she very quickly, you know, one of the biggest problems that she dealt with and discussed frequently was that women were paid so much less than men that it made them vulnerable to all other kinds of abuse, and of course left them in often desperate poverty. So she was very interested in improving economic conditions for women, and she felt like that could only happen when women really had the right to vote. She became very active in the suffrage movement. She'd been shy as a child, and she later said that the suffrage movement sort of helped her gain her voice. Women who wanted to fight for the right to vote would go out on a street corner. Often they'd pick a street corner where there was a saloon on every corner, pull up literally a soapbox, stand on it, and start to talk about how it was only just that women should have the right to vote. It made these women very, from a young age, learn how to talk about an unpopular subject. The women would be ridiculed and insulted, but it also gave them the courage to take on a hostile crowd and to learn how to turn a hostile crowd around. So not just did she learn a lot about community activism because of the suffrage movement, she also learned how to be a public speaker because of the suffrage movement. And she said it had been a life-changing event for her.
Yeah. It also seems that through her dealings with Tammany Hall following the fire, that she kind of simmered down the fiery rhetoric. And there was the story you tell in the book is very, I think, enlightening here, where you tell a story of her comforting a state senator.
Yes.
Hugh Frawley.
Yes, yes.
What did she glean from that experience? What happened?
Well, it was really interesting because she hardly knew him at all. But there was an impeachment of the governor of New York going on, and it was a purely political impeachment. His friends had turned against him, and they wanted to punish him, and they were impeaching him. And Hugh Frawley knew all the people involved, and he was very distressed that the governor wouldn't just back down and give in and avoid the impeachment proceeding by capitulating to Tammany Hall, and he saw her in the hallway on Capitol Hill in Albany, and he approached her and he came up close to her and he started to pour out his heart about how upset he was about what was being done to the governor, how unjust he thought it was. And she drew back. She didn't really know him that well. She drew back and she said, you know, and sort of asked him why was he telling her this. And he was trying to explain why it seemed to him so wrong what they were doing. And it was that he thought of the man as a son, the governor as a son. And he said, every man's got a mother, you know. And he used that as a way to explain to her that every man should be able to identify with the fact that you'd want to avoid hurting your mother. She laughed about it at the time. Hugh was kind of a silly man and sort of a Tammany Hall politico himself. And she repeated the story a few times to her friends. But then she realized that she had learned something really important from him about how highly men respect their mothers. And she began to dress very differently after that. She had a revelation that she could be more respected and more credible if she looked more like a matron, more like a middle-aged mother, and less like a pretty girl that they might want to date.
Mm.
You see her adopt the little, you know, the tricorn hat, the dark jacket, the little pearls around her neck, no makeup, very simple clothing. In her early 20s, people described her as fashionable. Some of the early pictures show her in those beautiful Gibson Girl blouses with the lovely, you know, with the lovely white ruffles at the neck and sleeves. But you'll see that after about 1920, you really only see her dressed as a staid matron, looking very much like a mother.
Very interesting.
And she felt that increased her effectiveness.
Yeah. This is the Afternoon Magazine. Journalist Kirsten Downey is our guest this afternoon. She's the author of The Woman Behind the New Deal, The Life of Frances Perkins, FDR's Secretary of Labor, and His Moral Conscience. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, you can join us today with questions, comments, 333-9455. That's the number in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-WILL, toll-free, 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Let's take a call from a listener in Champaign on line one. Good afternoon.
Is it one?
Yep, go ahead.
Yes. A while back, there was a very interesting question raised about how the New Deal Democrats differed from the Obama Democrats. I thought that was most interesting, and I keep thinking to myself all the time how wise it would be if the Obama people would read books about the New Deal, because the biggest difference between the people in the White House in the 30s and those today is that those people were unrelenting in getting things done. There is a brain trust, and the people put on brass knuckles, and they didn't take Social Security and say, oh, let the Congress do it. Let there be the Republicans say this and the Democrats say that. They told the people in the Congress, this is what we're going to do. And Roosevelt had these people put the brass knuckles on, Harry Hopkins and, yes, people like Frances Perkins,
right,
and Ickes, and so on and so forth. And Roosevelt himself, if he had what they have today, people saying, well, I'm a Blue Dog Democrat, Roosevelt would have called them in and said, you're a Blue Dog Democrat? Do you want to be a Dead Dog Democrat? Well, if you want to be a Dead Dog Democrat, you don't follow my prescriptions. Now, Obama made a big mistake when he turned the health thing over to Congress. He never should have done that. That you don't give sausage making over to the Congress because they'll make it out of dog meat. So what you do is you say, this is our program, you do it. And as far as Republicans, Roosevelt always said, every one of them hates me, and I relish their hatred. And that's a wholly different approach from what we have today, and
right.
I wish we could get some of it.
Well, that's a really great point. And certainly there's a huge difference in how conciliatory Obama has been trying to be. I also agree with you that one of the very big differences is that Roosevelt and his New Deal allies like Francis Perkins and Henry Wallace and Harry Hopkins were very oriented to helping people, not to helping business. And that's a very big difference in focus. There are many aspects of Obama's economic stimulus package that are helping people. The whole continuation of unemployment insurance has had a huge impact. The fact that very few jobs have yet to materialize yet, a lot of people are really surviving basically because of the economic stimulation package, which has allowed unemployment insurance to continue. But that's exactly right. Frances Perkins, when they put together a cabinet-level committee that came up with what was the Social Security Act, and it included Social Security, unemployment insurance, and a lot of what is were the early parts of the welfare system. At that time, though, of course, we need to remember it was geared to helping women who were widows and their children, and also women who were abandoned by husbands who had, in many cases, lost their jobs and sort of fled from their families. They were very focused, however, on giving people employment. One of the most popular programs launched almost immediately by FDR was the Civilian Conservation Corps, and it created 3 million jobs for mainly young men, but some young women as well, across America. It put them to work in national parks and in doing all kinds of infrastructure and public improvement projects. That would be possibly a very valuable program now. I saw the latest Bureau of Labor Statistics numbers on unemployment, and it's reporting that our teenage unemployment rate right now is 26%, and a lot of those older teens could really get some valuable training through a CCC-type program.
Yeah. Do you think because of the success of Frances Perkins and others in the Roosevelt administration and the successes of FDR himself, the 40-hour work week, a minimum wage, workers' compensation, unemployment compensation, banning child labor, direct federal aid for unemployment relief, and Social Security among them, that because of these programs, that the fire maybe isn't as hot for what the Obama administration would like to do?
Well, I think a lot of people have simply forgotten what it was like before these programs were created. I was really amused by how many people were standing up at these healthcare forums to say, we don't want government interference. Don't mess with my Medicare. Not realizing that Medicare is a federal program. And I think there's been a lot of people who have forgotten what it was like. I think one of the things that is fascinating, and I studied and wrote a lot about economic boom and bust cycles, and at the Post I was an economics reporter, and I was writing about the growth of these new toxic loans and the problems they were going to cause. And one of the fascinating things is one of the things that actually led to the Great Depression was a growth in very similar kinds of loans in the 1920s. And in fact, there had to eventually be a big bailout. There was an organization called the Federal Home Loan Insurance Corporation, Mortgage Corporation, I think, I'm sorry, that allowed millions of Americans to refinance their homes. And so a lot of people that even think today that their families got through the Great Depression relatively unscathed don't realize that that may be because Granddad was able to refinance through a federal program.
Yeah.
That's one of the things that's really been lacking thus far is a comprehensive solution for dealing with the mountain of foreclosures that are moving through the actually through the court system now.
Yeah. Maybe tell us a little bit about the National Housing Act.
Frances Perkins always believed that Insurance was a very good way to get the government involved, but to let the private sector run something. And she was the biggest supporter of FHA insurance in the cabinet. And in fact, that's, you know, when you look at all the things that she did, you really can see how that was one of the things that contributed to the prosperity of the 50s, 60s, and 70s were programs like FHA insurance. It's hard to say exactly how, if Frances Perkins were alive, how would she deal, how would she think that the foreclosure problem of today should be dealt with, but it would, I would imagine that it would be possible to find ways to use our current FHA insurance program and to refinance people's loans into these kinds of government-insured loans. Of course, the banks would have to be forced to go along with that, and thus far they haven't been very cooperative.
Hmm. Let's take another call, a listener in Effingham waiting for us on line four. Hi.
Yes. Did I just hear you say you had studied about toxic assets?
Yes.
Yes, okay. Well, in your studies, would you have learned about I'm trying to remember, IMST, something like that. I just saw this program on Frontline last night, that these people are a power unto themselves who created possibly, and I've heard allusions to it in the 30s, that this is what created the Great Depression. And then in 2006, it has all happened again. And the toxicity of the assets, and then focused on the housing market this time, and what, do you know anything about that organization or what the toxic asset or derivatives are, how that is employed?
Right. I don't. I've heard that there was a really interesting Frontline program on recently, but I'm sorry. I didn't.
Well, I thought maybe
the program. What I can tell you is that at the Washington Post, from 1905, from 2005 to 2007, I wrote more than 30 stories. Many of them ran on the front page of the Post, talking about the growth in. At first, we called them non-traditional mortgages, and then gradually it became more and more apparent that they were really that was really gilding the lily. You know, that they were toxic mortgages. People at first didn't even grasp how different they were than mortgages of the past because they were called things like adjustable mortgages, and people didn't. And people's awareness of an adjustable mortgage in the 70s was that, oh, it might be really bad, and your payment will go up $100. They didn't understand that these were the kinds of pick-your-own-payment mortgages that would where your payment could double or triple. And no one realized anyway, so we highlighted it. All I can tell you is that I wrote dozens of stories and took it to Bush administration officials regularly in every different government agency. They kept saying that they thought they would get around to doing something about it, but clearly they chose never to. And we're all dealing with the result.
The listener want to follow up?
Yes, please. There was another woman involved in that. Her name was Morning Something Bourne. I can't remember.
Brooksley Bourne.
Brooksley Bourne, yes. Yeah. And she was beaten down and ousted because she had all the means, all the laws in order that she were going to take these devils, I use that metaphorically, bring them to court. And she was jumped up and down on by Greenspan and this man who is in Obama's cabinet, a real killer.
Larry Summers.
Summers, yes. And one other fellow, he was a bourgeois sort of person in the financial things. I don't want to distract from the main subject here, but again, Ms. Bourne and her efforts, and I think it relates to what you're talking about and the contempt which patriarchal society has had and continues to have for women of great stature, you know, which, I mean, for that Ms. Bourne to take on those people and take it as far as she could before she was ousted was just very meaningful to me because of I am a basic maternalist. because without mother, there's nothing. And when mother is removed from everyday society and she has no power, it only then suborns the everyone to patriarchal greed and violence. But anyway, well, it's a great show, and I'm so glad that to listen in, and thank you, dear.
Well, thank you. I guess I would have to say I do, you know, of course I'm aware of Brooks Lieborn, and I have been aware of what she was trying to do to raise flags. I can tell you myself, I think it's laughable when Alan Greenspan now says he didn't know what he was doing. In fact, when I began writing my stories at the Post about this growing problem, in fact, we called it on the front page a growth of risky mortgages, and we said it could bring down the financial system. Their reaction at the Fed, the Public Information Department, called my colleagues at the Post and said I was mistaken, that I was embarrassing the paper, and they put pressure on me to stop writing the stories.
Hmm. And how did the paper respond?
They were a little queasy because not a lot of other papers were picking it up. The New York Times was notably absent on this problem, and some of the other papers were as well. But they kept publishing the stories, and I really think you can say for the Washington Post that they stuck with it and did their best.
We've got to wrap up. We're out of time.
Okay.
Kirsten Downey, thank you very much for talking with us this afternoon.
Thank you so much for having me.
Kirsten Downey is a frequent contributor to the Washington Post, where she was a staff writer from 1988 to 2008, winning Press Association awards for her business and economics reporting. She shared in the 2008 Pulitzer Prize for the paper's coverage of the Virginia Tech shootings. She is the author of The Woman Behind the New Deal, The Life of Frances Perkins, FDR's Secretary of Labor, and His Moral Conscience. The book is published by Nantahlise Doubleday. 1:53 Central Time. We turn things over now to Todd Gleason. He has settlement prices for us from Chicago and Kansas City.
December wheat for the day, a 5.55 and three quarters top, bottom at 5.33 and a half, and a settlement price at 5.51 and three quarters, up 9 1/4. Let me start over with that so you can get all the numbers. December contract, 5.55 and three quarters, the top, the bottom at 33 and a half, a settlement price at 5.51 and three quarters, up 9 1/4 for the day. The March contract, 5.73, the high, the low at 51 and a quarter, settlement price at 5.69 and a quarter, up 9 cents. In May futures, 5.83 and a half, the high, the low at 5.63 and three quarters, settlement price at $5.80, up 8 3/4. July futures, 5.91 and three quarters, the high, the low at 71, settlement price at 5.88, up 8. And September contract, a $6.75 top, bottom at 5.83, settlement price 5.95 and three quarters, up 5 3/4. From the corn pit today, 5 1/4 cents the gain in the nearby December contract, 4.05 the top, the bottom of the 3.93 and a quarter, settlement price at 4.03 and a half, up 5 1/4. In the March contract, 4.16 the high, the low at 4.05 and a half, settled at 4.14 and three quarters, up 4 3/4. May futures, 4.24 and a half the high, the low at 4.14 and a quarter, settlement price at 4.23 and 1/2, up 5 cents. And July corn, 4.31 the high, the low at 21 and three quarters, settlement $4.30 and a quarter of a cent, up 4 1/2 cents. Next year's December, the 2010 contract at 4.36 for the high, the low at 27 and three quarters, 2010 December corn at 4.35 on its settlement price, 3 3/4 of a cent higher. December oats today, 2.64 and one quarter the high, the low at 58 and a quarter, settlement price at 2.64 and a quarter, up on its top, a penny and a quarter higher. The March contract up a penny and a half at 2.77 and one quarter. November soybeans, $10.95 the high, the low at 9.94, settled $10.05 down 3. January 10.11 the high, the low at 9.95 and three quarters, settled at 10.07, 2 3/4 lower. And the March contract 10.09 and a quarter the high, the low at 9.97 and a half, settled $10.06 and and three quarters of a cent, down a penny and a quarter. May futures, 10.02 and three quarters the high, the low at 9.90. Settlement price at $10, down a penny and a half. And July futures, $10.02 the high, the low at 9.90. Settled 9.98 and a quarter, down 2 1/4. November soybeans, 9.91 and three quarters the high, the low at 9.80. Settlement price at $9.88, down a penny and a half. December bean meal today, 3.02.50 the high for the afternoon, the low at 2.96. Settlement price at $300.80, up $2.10. January futures, $2.94.50, up $2.50. December bean oil, 38.61 the high, the low at 37.85. Settlement price at 38.30, down 26. And January futures, 38.75, down 26 for the day. During the closing mark report this afternoon, it's 6 after the hour of 2 o'clock. That's just about 9 minutes and 10 seconds away now. We'll talk with Dan Zwicker. He's at ADM Grain Group in Decatur, Illinois. Back then, I'm Todd Gleason.
Agricultural programs are made possible by Risk Management Commodities Incorporated in Lafayette, Indiana, Chalmers, Indiana, Hudsonville, Illinois, and Crescent City, Illinois. Risk Management Commodities focuses on managing risk in today's complex and sophisticated commodities market. 866-837-9027.
Next, we look at the livestock contracts. October live cattle, the high today in Chicago, 86.35. The low, 85.82.5. The settlement, 85.95, down 65. December, 87.40, the high, 86.80, the low. The settlement, 87.37.5, up 30. February, 87.80, the high, 87.20, the low. 87.75, the settlement, up 32.5. April, 89.60, the high, 89.15, the low, 89.57.5, the settlement, up 20. October feeder cattle, 94.70, the high, 94.35, the low, 94.45, the settlement, down 5. November, 96.40, the high, 95.90, the low, 96.40, the settlement, up 17.5. January, 96.70, the high, 96.15, the low, 96.67.5, the settlement, down a nickel. March, 97.20, the high, the low, 96.70, the settlement, 97.17.5, up 2.5. December lean hogs, 54 even, the high, 53.30, the low, 53.72.5, the settlement, up a nickel. February, 60.80, the high, 60.25, the low, the settlement, 60.72.5, up 12.5. April, 65.60, the high, 65.05, the low, 65.47.5, the settlement, that up a nickel. And May, 71.20, the high, 70.50, the low, 70.97.5, the settlement, that up 2.5. February, bellies, 83.80, the high, 81.20, the low, and the settlement today for bellies, 83.50, that up $2. The Dow is currently up 122 points at 10,071. The NASDAQ is up 10 points at 2,161. The S&P 500 is up 9 points at 1,091. And crude oil down 23, trading at $81.14 a barrel.